Support for KNKX and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, reminding listeners that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. And these brown and black cows that you're hearing, they live on a 180-acre ranch in Soap Lake in eastern Washington. It's owned by the McMillan family. They run a feedlot. This is where cows bulk up before becoming steak dinners. The McMillans also supply rodeos with horses that are bred to buck and bulls to cowboys who have a hard time staying on them for more than 8 seconds. The McMillans have 10 children. 6 of them are adopted. Josie joined the McMillans when she was just a baby. Now she's 10. And on the day we meet, she is sitting on top of her black and white paint pony, Rebels, who has one eye, but he does just fine. They're riding in an outdoor arena behind the house.
He's a good pony because he listens sometimes. Sometimes.
What are you going to show us?
I'm going to show you spin the horn, just going around the horn. And I might do 2 more tricks because I can. I know how to do the backwards 1 foot stand and thread the needle, a secret trick.
For the last several years, the McMillan children have been performing at rodeos all over the western United States doing trick riding. And galloping horses, these kids ride backwards. They stand tall in the saddle, arms spread wide, resembling the figurehead of an old wooden ship. They hang off the side of their beloved pets, holding on with just their feet hooked into a special saddle. Their bodies are parallel to the ground. We're going to find out what their mom thinks of all this in just a minute. But first, in case you're wondering, all of the stories today on Sound Effect have something to do with parenthood and the relationship between parents and their kids. We'll hear a story about a daughter seeing her mom step away from her role as a parent and what she's like. Also, what happens when our parents disappoint us, when they don't act the way we think they should? And what are the crazy things we parents do to help our kids? We'll hear some of these stories coming up. But first, let's get back to the ranch in Soap Lake, where the McMillan kids, including 10-year-old Josie, do dangerous things on the backs of fast-moving large animals, things most parents would say absolutely no to.
It's all about they trust their horse, and so what seems scary to you and I, they got it.
That's Lynette McMillan, Josie's mom, and the mom to Riley, Hannah, Zane, Landon, Josh, Caleb, Big Josh, Nick, and Davey.
Sometimes the horse will be going like super fast and I'm like going, oh my gosh.
Do you ever look away?
Sometimes I squint my eyes and so I can just barely see them. And for some reason that keeps them safe. I don't know why, but it does.
Lynette and her husband, Mark, they didn't plan to have such a big family, but they got an idea of what it would be like by watching their close friends, Shelley and Jay, take in foster kids.
So Mark and I would go visit, and we would see Jay take these kids with him. They would work, they called it the sheep station, and they'd have to ride their horses like, 10 miles in the freezing cold and, gather cows and stuff. And they loved what they did, and they loved Jay, and they loved the hard work. And you could just see that it was good for these kids. It was just, they were thriving in this situation. And so Mark's like, let's get licensed for foster care. And the day we got licensed, they called us with a little boy, Nicholas. And he was 4 years old. And I couldn't even take him shopping because he would run from my car and just run out into traffic and stuff because he had been neglected. And my husband even said, Lynette, I don't know if we can keep him safe. And so I was going into a meeting at CPS, with all the social workers and stuff, and I was going to tell them that we just couldn't do it. And I got there, and I'm pretty sure it was the Holy Spirit putting the, chain on my lips, and I could not say the words that, and I said, we'll take him.
The youngest McMillan is Landon. He arrived when he was just 2 years old. the other foster family he was with was overwhelmed.
And they told us, they said he cusses and he's disrespectful to women. And I'm thinking to myself, how could a two-year-old, but he was. And it was amazing, some of the stuff that would come out of his mouth and stuff at two and a half, you know, but still, it was amazing. And we had an eyeful and an earful. And but, you know, he's gotten better over the years as that fresh air and that exercise and stuff. You know, he was a lot easier to deal with. And so that's kind of where we have ended so far.
What was your childhood like where that maybe seeded this?
My mom and dad were givers, and they would take anyone in, you know, and I remember my brother's friends coming over and living with us for a little while, you know what I mean? And so I learned from example. I mean, they would give you the shirt off of their back.
Taking these children into your lives and bringing them into the fold of your family, what was the risk that you and Mark talked about?
When the kiddos, especially when you bring these older kids in, what they have been exposed to, I mean, we just, something that we probably, you know, will never in my life, you know, experience. And these kiddos, since they were little, have like lived this. And, you know, they know a lot more than my kids. You know what I mean? My kids are pretty naive to, you know, the drugs and the sexual stuff and just everything. You know what I mean? There is a lot of, you know, that goes on in these homes that I don't even know about, you know what I mean? And then they bring that to your kids. But on the other side, my kids, they would take in, you know, if another kid showed up at our door right now and they said, hey, you know, he needs a home, my kids would be the first ones begging me, you know, let's take another one. Let's bring them into our home. And so my kids are giving. And I'm not saying that they don't ever say, what did you adopt him for in the bad moments and stuff. But you go to school and they stick up for each other till the end. If we can give these kids the foundation that they need, then they can go out and then they're going to have families that'll mirror ours. And that's what I'm hoping, because a lot of them come from broken homes and they never see, you know, the full circle of what, you know, what a family can be.
Trick riding. How did that get started?
My mom was a trick rider in New York, upstate New York. Her mom and dad owned a dude ranch, and her dad wanted her to learn how to trick ride so that she could perform for the guests. And so she trick rode when she was younger. She had all these pictures and stuff, and I always, you know, would look at those pictures and want to be a trick rider, but she was afraid. She's like, oh, no, because too dangerous. And so in the back of my mind, I always, and at the rodeos, I would see trick riders, and it always intrigued me, and I liked it.
Two of the McMillan girls wanted to try it out, so Lynette sent them to a trick riding camp in Colorado.
And they came home, and we got on our horses here at home, and the kids, it just took off, it really did. And then they taught the other kids. And so before you knew it, we were traveling all over the United States. It's just really weird how it just fell into place.
So far, the only injury the McMillan kids have suffered by doing trick riding is a broken foot. One of the boys lost his balance and had to quickly jump off the back of his horse. Lynette and her husband say they're not going to take in any more kids, but their family did just get a little bigger. They had another baby 2 months ago. She is a bit of a surprise, and she has the best name for a future cowgirl, Ace Sloan McMillan. Someday, the McMillans want to make their ranch a place where other foster parents can come with their children and bond by working outside together in the fresh air. To see photos of the McMillan kids in action, go to our website, knkx.org. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. And again, today we're telling stories that all have something to do with parenthood. And this next story, it's about turning the tables on the traditional parent-child dynamic. Kids have these thoughts about their parents, especially as teenagers. Who are these people? Where do they come from? Parents just don't understand. Well, Sound Effect producer Allie Ferguson, she got a chance, an open window, really, to meet her mom as she was when she was in her early 20s.
It involves an old cassette tape, a road trip, and a diary.
I'm not sure what it is about this recorder, but we both seem to be talking like this.
That's my mom, Polly. She's about 26 or 27 at the time, and she discovered these tapes a few months ago while cleaning her house. They're these mini cassettes from the 90s that fit into a small black recorder.
I don't even know why I had a tape recorder, but apparently it was a toy that I had to have. And then we started using it on the road trip.
That's my mom today. It's been nearly a quarter century since she made those tapes. She's almost 50, and I'm about the same age she was in the recordings. The two of us have always been close.
Are you nervous?
Yes, because I want the microphone.
You can't hold the mic. It's like Reporter 101, don't give anyone your microphone.
Really?
But listening to these tapes, eavesdropping on my mom in her 20s is surreal. To be clear, at the time of the recordings, I was already born. My mom was already a mom. She was not some 20-something with no care in the world like me. But in these tapes, she's living the life of a young, independent woman, a side of her I wasn't old enough to see back then.
I'm driving down the road looking at the picturesque sunset. How beautiful, I say to myself. As I'm cruising down the road at 65, yes, 10 miles above the speed limit. Am I afraid?
That last voice, that's my mom's best friend, Rachel. And she's an important part of understanding my mom at that age. The two of them have known each other since middle school in Montana. And then in their early 20s, they both gave birth to daughters, Sarah and me, within 2 days of each other. When I was just a toddler, my mom and my dad and I resettled from Montana to San Diego. When I was nearly four, my parents decided to separate, and Rachel and her daughter Sarah took on a big part of our lives. They came out to San Diego and moved in with my mom and me.
I think during the time I was struggling with your dad, she was feeling very lost with her husband, and I think when she actually decided to come move out here was when I got a condo that was a little bit bigger, and she was kind of like, yeah, I want to do it. So they lived with us for 5 years.
So for 5 years, it was me, my mom, Rachel, and Sarah, all sharing a home in suburban San Diego. It was weird to explain to other kids and teachers, but Sarah and I never cared. We always thought of ourselves as roommates, a never-ending sleepover. My mom and Rachel, young mothers in their 20s, went from best friends to co-parents.
We took turns, and it was a lot of tag-team parenting. Hey, you're going to do homework and feed the girls, and I'm going to go out and do happy hour with my coworkers or whatever it was.
And so what was it like when you were the mom who was tasked with taking care of us for the night?
Well, I love that too. I mean, I really enjoyed being your mom, and I enjoyed hanging out with you guys, and it was easy to do homework with you. Well, with you were great. Sarah was a little harder to do homework with.
But both me and Sarah had our dads who we would go see. What was it like when both me and Sarah were gone?
Oh, it's kind of hard to look at you and tell you what it was like, because it was like immediate, let's put the toys and the crap away and let's live like single girls living together, going out to the pool, going out at night. It was the ultimate freedom.
How did you guys handle dating with both of us at the house?
So we kind of sat down and made an agreement that, you know, we weren't going to have any dates come to the house, at least for the first few years when you guys were so young. But there was a time when Rachel had a few boyfriends and she didn't want them calling and saying who they were to you girls, because then you would be wondering who it was. So we decided everybody would be called man. So when man called, we didn't really know who the man was.
So you and Rachel created these spaces for yourself to be young women, to not necessarily always be mothers all the time. And one of those cases is you guys go to Nebraska to surprise her mom for her 50th birthday.
No? No, the party was simply a Tupperware party.
It wasn't her birthday? You just went for a Tupperware party.
Yeah, but her mom was really excited and nervous about it. And Rachel decided, because she loved her mother so much, that she really wanted to surprise her for this Tupperware party.
We are here in Trenton. I can't believe it. It's so exciting. The excitement is just building up. Ah! This town is definitely happening. Things are happening all over the place. Wait a minute. It looks like it's rolled up.
How would you describe your and Rachel's friendship? What was it like when you guys were together?
It was just silly time. It was constant silly time. When I first met her in middle school till now, we can still be just as silly. We'll still get dressed up in costumes, I mean, not nice, and do silly things.
Oh, we're driving down this dirt alley and the weeds are taller than the car, but that's okay, it's a rental. Okay, lights are out on the car. Soon we will be getting our stuff together and our bags on our head.
Can you explain the bags?
Rachel had some paper bags and we pulled over once to draw on them and mine was scary. It had bloody teeth out of it. And I was thinking, that is funny to draw a scary mask to go jump a Tupperware party.
Is that something Rachel and you would do?
Definitely. We like the surprise factor. We like the, I don't know, just doing something that nobody else would ever do. And that was true of any time we were together.
Why do you think you wanted to stand out?
I don't know. Maybe because in high school we felt like we were, you know, like not really seen.
We're trying to sneak into the garage without tripping over these rocks. Do you hear the crickets? I do.
What do you remember about the actual surprise?
I was just so nervous and we had to go through this back entrance for some reason. That's why I was tripping on things. But her mom, her expression and her, she was crying. It was so sweet that she would be so, you know, excited.
What did the rest of the crowd think?
They were just kind of staring at us. And you would think that they would think we were burglars.
Listening to this tape, getting to hear my mom in her 20s not in mom mode, makes me realize how goofy my mom has always been. She's playful and a little fearless, which I guess are necessary qualities to choose such a creative parenting situation. My mom never second-guessed her choices, even when her own family did.
I had an uncle who told me that, you know, if I was going to remain single mother, that my child would not have a very good chance in life. And that was frustrating to hear the older generation not accept my situation. And then there was also the, you know, as it became 1 year and 2 years and 5 years that we're together, me and my best friend with our daughters, there's this questioning of, you know, what are those two doing? Are they a couple? And we weren't.
So there's a lot of people questioning your judgment and judging you.
Yeah, I felt judged. And, you know, most of your childhood was in this area where it's suburbia, the parents stay together, or when they divorce, they divorce. I think people were jealous, but they were also like looking at like, that's so weird.
That's hard to deal with all of that kind of judgment from society, from people you know, your family. Why do you think you were able to push past that?
I don't know. I think it's an internal security of who I was. I mean, I was in my 20s and 30s, and we all feel insecure at some point, but I just didn't feel insecure about how I was raising you. I didn't really care what they thought. I mean, I just had no doubt. I don't know where the inner strength comes from. I don't know if it's from the ranch upbringing.
I should step in here and say, my mom grew up on a ranch in Montana with three older brothers. They learned how to drive cars, shoot guns, and help out with cattle at a very young age. And there wasn't a ton of parental supervision in rural Montana in the 70s.
Maybe being the only girl in a very masculine environment all those years, I didn't have a choice. You know, you survive or you crawl up under a hole and have rattlesnakes thrown at you. You know?
That's very literal, by the way.
Yeah, very literal. Yeah, you have to keep your doors locked on the car or a rattlesnake might be thrown at you. But they were not alive, Allie. They were always dead. It was just disgusting.
Yep, that's my mom. Always one to laugh about the fact that her brothers threw dead snakes at her as a kid. I often wish I had more of her humor, her resilience, her playfulness.
Well, I think that's great advice for you, to be more playful and not take yourself so seriously or, you know, get mired down in what you should be doing at what age. You know, it can come and it can go and you can have tragedy and you can have great stuff, but being playful is something you can create no matter what you have or don't have.
These old tapes showed me that, of how my mom managed to be so fully herself, a young, independent woman, and a working mom, all at the same time. But she has always been trying to make sure I had the whole picture.
To my unborn child, the following journal is written to you in hopes that later on in life you will read it and understand what I was like at 24 years old. I know that I always wondered what my parents were like, way back when. Someday, if you are anything like your dad or I, you will also want to know where we started and how we felt. I also think it is important for you to realize how human I am and not see me as just your mother, but as an individual who is constantly learning.
So when did you write that?
It was about, I don't know, a week before you were born. 4 days before you were born.
My mom gave me this faded yellow notebook this past Christmas. And it made me realize that even at 24, my mom understood a secret about parenting. There's power in flipping the script, in letting your child see you for who you really are. I think it's what makes me and my mom so close. We're both constantly learning from everything, especially each other.
That story from sound effect producer Allie Ferguson. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. As a parent, it is painful to watch your child struggle in school. Michael Long was one of these kids when he was growing up in Indianapolis. Today, he's a humor writer and a website developer who lives in Seattle. Mike's dad had a dental practice. His mother was a former Fulbright scholar in mathematics. These are successful people. And they were worried about their son, who was failing.
I was one of the kids that you see in every class. There's like one boy, or there's a couple of boys, maybe some girls, but usually the boys that are off, like staring off into space or drawing something on their notebook when they're supposed to be paying attention, or they're just obviously not interested.
Mike's teachers tried everything. Nothing worked.
The teachers always had these different discipline techniques. So there was the name on the board thing. I spent most of elementary school with my name on the board for one thing or another. I just didn't pay attention to anything. I just had like zero attention span for anything that I wasn't completely interested in. And that included almost everything in school.
Mike would have rather been lost inside a book.
I was really into The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. So I'd read those books and I even got the records. They had records for The Hobbit. And I listened to that record constantly.
So if you're reading Lord of the Rings and your parents see this, and then they see you coming home with the report cards full of
D's, pretty much. D's are worse.
They must have been kind of frustrated.
Oh yeah, they were horrified, because my mom's, she had been valedictorian of her high school, and she'd barely ever gotten a B in her entire life. And I think she viewed my grades as sort of an extension of herself. So when I would bring things home like that, I think it was really traumatizing to her. It wasn't traumatizing to me at all until it was traumatizing to her.
What things did your parents try to do to improve your grades?
They tried lots of things. They tried a lot of things that involved doctors. And I don't even know what all the doctors did. I mean, some of it involved various drugs. But the worst one was definitely the crawling. That was the most memorable out of all the therapies.
Yes, you heard that right. Crawling, like a baby.
So my dad somehow heard about Dr. Smithson, and he explained to my parents that my academic problems, or the academic problems of a lot of children, as I understood it, were caused because they didn't crawl enough as toddlers. And that I had really bad handwriting. So what I think it was that somehow your bad handwriting caused you not to be frustrated when you were doing schoolwork. And the reason you had the bad handwriting to begin with was because you didn't crawl enough as a child. My dad would, I think it was pretty much, start crawling. He wasn't having it. He just told me, you know, start crawling.
And crawling is not a euphemism for something else. We're talking about literally getting on the ground on your hands and knees.
Yeah. And yeah, that's exactly what it is. And crawling. And so I had to do it 40 laps around the house. But the problem with it was, since the doctor's theory was that I hadn't crawled enough as a toddler, they needed to make it really have a big impact. So in order for it to have an impact, they had different resistance techniques when you crawl. So what would happen would your parent would crawl with you, and they would either push your shoulders back or hold your feet in a certain way that made it harder.
So can you give us a visual of what this looked like?
We went through all the carpeted areas of the house because it was not fun to crawl on tiled floors. So we crawl down the hallway. We go through my parents' bedroom. At the far end of their bedroom, there was a wooden plaque inscribed with the Lord's Prayer. And then I would turn at that plaque because that indicated that I had half a lap done, and start crawling back. And my parents would have to go right along with me. They were usually holding my feet, kind of crawling behind me, holding my feet. One of my parents, they didn't have, both of them didn't have to do it, only one at a time. It was really humiliating for everyone involved.
Would your mom be watching and correcting you?
Yeah, especially at first. She was really concerned that we do it the exact way that this doctor had come up with, because she didn't want to waste. I mean, she does everything exact. So she'd always be leaning over and looking and seeing if my elbow was in the right place or my hand was in the right place, that type of thing.
And this happened every day?
Every day, yeah.
For how long?
It was at least several months.
What would you say to your parent who you were crawling with on that particular day? What kind of conversation would you have with them?
Oh, we wouldn't talk much while we were doing it, but beforehand we would always have a fight.
What would you tell them?
That I wasn't going to do it, flat out. There's no way I was going to do it. I mean, it was humiliating. Even at 10, you don't want your friends to find out that you have to crawl around your house with a parent attached for half an hour each night. That's not something you want anybody to know. And so my parents, at the time I was collected football cards, that was my reward for doing the crawling each week, was that I would get a pack of football cards or two packs of football cards. But I remember there were several times I just was like absolutely refused to do it. And that was when she would usually break out the football cards.
Did their belief in this therapy ever falter?
It started to look like it was working. My handwriting was actually improving. But it was only improving because I didn't want to crawl around the house. So I figured I better put in a little more effort. Which, luckily, I'd set the bar so low. If I did anything else, it probably would have looked like a giant success.
It did work. It sounds like it got the ball rolling to get you to kind of buck up a bit.
About halfway through fourth grade, I really started to care. And then I really started to try. And I got straight A's by fifth grade. I mean, I think it was one of the first times I actually realized that I was going to need some level of discipline.
Do you remember when it ended? What that day was like? What was going through your mind when you were processing the news that you didn't have to do this anymore?
I mean, I remember being really, really happy that I didn't have to crawl. And I also remember I had the most amazing collection of football cards, probably within the metropolitan Indianapolis. I mean, I had a lot of football cards.
Mike Long, he lives in Seattle. Several years ago, Mike became a parent. And when his daughter was a baby and was learning how to crawl, he felt absolutely no need to prolong this phase in her life. This is Sound Effect on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing. And again today on the show, all of our stories have something to do with parenthood. Think back to when you were a kid and try to remember the places you associate with your parents, the places that helped define them in your child's mind. Was it the kitchen, the garden, the office? Well, at the Triangle Bar in South Philadelphia, this is where I first grasped the fact that my dad really loves food. I was sitting at the bar with him when he successfully introduced me to mussels in red sauce. I was 8 years old. Dad would have a beer. I'd nurse my Shirley Temple. In Philly, still to this day, kids are allowed in bars. Food writer Nancy Leeson, who's also half of 88.5's Food for Thought duo, also grew up in Philadelphia. She started going to her local tavern when she was around 6 years old. She told Sound Effects' Gabriel Spitzer that's where she would find her mother.
My mom was a single mom for some time and very young, and raising four very young children, I was the oldest. And my mom would excuse herself and go down to maybe have a little adult companionship down the block. And she'd tell me that if I needed to find her, I knew where to find her.
So otherwise you were home alone with your siblings.
That's right. So my earliest memories of being in a bar were being in a place called Les Brown's Tap Room. And Les's Tap Room was in a clutch of stores on a commercial strip where we used to live when I was a kid. And Uncle Les Brown, uncle in quotes, was a really friendly fella who ran a place where people could come and drink and grab something to eat. And my mother was often there, and I would find her there and sit right up at the bar with her, as would my siblings. And we'd get to do wonderful things like eat Slim Jims and pickled eggs and hard-boiled eggs. And then, of course, there was a Coca-Cola with as many maraschino cherries as you could fit in there.
And would you look forward to that?
Yeah, I would. I felt very comfortable there. It was a comfortable neighborhood place, a Cheers-like place, of course, as everyone says, and it really was that.
So was that place one of a kind for you, or were there other places that did the same thing for you later?
Well, I mean, that was a one-of-a-kind place for me, but I also have very distinct memories over time of being in bars with my mother and my stepfather, even. So when I was a young teen, we used to stop at a place called the Indian Chief. It was on the way down to the seashore, down the shore in New Jersey. I distinctly recall having my very first clams on the half shell. And, you know, these are raw clams on the half shell. And so I was maybe, I don't know, 10 or something. And the waitress was so very impressed with my prowess of knocking back these raw clams that she bought me another half a dozen clams on the half shell on the house.
Wow. Do your siblings have similar recollections of these places? And do they have the same kind of affection for them that you do?
I don't know if affection would be the right word, in particular for the Indian Chief, because we had an interesting and, for some of it, somewhat traumatizing thing happen at that bar at some point a little later on. We were on our way home from the Jersey Shore, and we stopped there as we had done before. And my mother got into a conversation with some motorcycle guys. And somehow the conversation with these guys who were traveling from I don't know where to I don't know where, it came about that they needed a place to stay. And my mother, over the course of this afternoon or late afternoon in this place, invited them to come back, to follow us back in the car and come to our house and stay in our recreation room, which didn't go over really well with my stepfather and certainly did not go over well with me.
What do you remember thinking about it?
That it was wrong, that it was crazy, that there's only so much friendliness in a bar that you can take so far, that each of the kids got on the back of a motorcycle, as did my mother, for the fun ride home, and that I got into my stepdad's Dodge Dart and was scared and frightened and probably even crying. And we did get home, and I didn't want to stay in the house. I mean, I was youngish, but I was old enough to know that this was frightening, at least to me, and wrong. And I spent the night at my grandmother's. When I asked my stepfather recently if he remembered that story, he remembered it very well. And he said he recalls that it was the beginning of the end.
Of their marriage?
That's right. They were married for 11 years, but that was when he realized that it wasn't going to work.
Was there something about that and the decisions that she made there that give you a handle on what was going on with her at that time and why that relationship and whatever else didn't work out?
She was young and foolish, I think, at that time, and a fun-loving person, I guess, who wasn't thinking beyond that to the health and well-being of her children, which was, I think, true of much of how she was as a parent. You know, she was responsible for four kids for part of that time on her own. She never had a chance to be a kid. From the time I could remember, I was the adult and she was the child. And I realized very early on that I was in charge of my siblings. And I think I did that for a time until I couldn't take it anymore. And I actually left home when I was 15. Yeah, I never lived with my mother again.
Did your mom have a drinking problem?
Yeah, she certainly did. She drank quite a bit. She was, in fact, an alcoholic.
So as you think back on your actual childhood experiences of being in those bars, finding your mother there, you describe those as being very warm memories and you having kind of affection toward it. Are they not tinged with the complicated stuff that would soon develop between you and your mom?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that for me, those were happy places because she was happy there in those bars. And compared to, I guess, sitting in an apartment with four little kids, maybe that was fun for her. And you know what they say, if mama's happy, everybody's happy.
How do you feel telling these stories now?
Well, I feel okay telling the stories now because my mom died just very recently. She died in April, and it's not as if I haven't told these stories before in a good-hearted, a good-natured way, written about them, shared them with my siblings, with friends, with my husband, whatever. But I feel like I can talk about her now in a way, now that she's gone, in a more honest way. Like any mother, they loom large over who you are and what you become. But I've always felt proud in the knowledge that the things that were wrong with her. They weren't wrong with me. Her story is what made my story, but her story isn't my story.
For all of us, and I'm guessing for you especially, our memories and food are so tied together. Do you ever have transformative moments when you have a piece of beef jerky or you you have one of those eggs or you think about that what sounds like one of the last really warm, close, not so complicated points in your life that you had with your mom?
I think about that every time I eat clams on the half shell. I think about it not infrequently when my husband puts a maraschino cherry in his Manhattan. And I certainly think about it when I'm standing in line at a 7-Eleven or at a grocery store somewhere and I see a box of Slim Jims. Regularly now when I'm sitting at a bar enjoying a drink, I wish that my son were sitting next to me. And soon enough, he'll be 21 and old enough to have that seat next to me. And I hope that when he does, we have a kick-ass great time.
Well, Nancy Leeson, a KPLU food commentator, half of Food for Thought and friend of the show, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
tuned to Sound Effect here on 88.5 KNKX. I'm Jennifer Wing, and our theme again this week is parenthood. So what do you do when you feel like you have to say something to your mom or your dad that you've never said out loud, and it's really important? Sound Effect contributor Dominic Black found himself in exactly this situation.
When I think back on it now, when I was growing up, there were two things that were really hard for me to tell my parents. And the first was, hey, mom and dad, we're getting sex education at school. And the second one was, I love you.
I don't want to talk about this. I want to be clear about what exactly you want to hear.
So a bit of background. That's my dad in 1997, 2 years before he died.
Well, I can work clearly on this.
Yeah. That's the one time I tried to record my dad. And as you can tell, he wasn't entirely comfortable with the whole situation, which is fair enough. Right? We were sitting at the foot of the kitchen table at our house on the north coast of Ireland. And my mum is ironing in the background.
Hello, Dominic. How are you?
That's her. She had 12 kids. I'm number 10. I have two younger sisters.
When are you taking that beard off?
My beard was a perennial preoccupation for my mum. But getting her to talk was easy. She'd tell you she had nothing to say and then she'd go on for an hour.
What do you want me to tell you?
Right, well, tell me what you were going to tell me there.
You asked the question.
Right, well, how did you and Dad meet then?
Well, I was wanting to go to the tech to do short...
And she was full of mischief. She'd cheat at cards and then she'd deny it and then she'd say something like, you're not too old for a slap in the ear, you know, you cheeky article. But Dad was different. For one thing, he was born in 1916. He was 14 years older than Mum. And by the time I went to university in 1986, he was already 70 and still working. And then there was the vexing Irish question. Dad was careful about what he'd say and who he'd say it to. Growing up a Catholic in Northern Ireland, his experience and his father's experience taught him that saying the wrong thing could get you in trouble. The capital T troubles when I was growing up were a sort of constant background noise. 30-odd years of, what, civil war, I suppose, and troops in the streets. And so I'd go off on a teenage rant about Margaret Thatcher and something she'd done or something she'd said. And Mum and Dad's response was always, don't you be saying anything. Or, as the folk song from the time had it,
whatever you say nothing when you speak about you know what. For if you know who should hear you, you know what you'll get. They'll take you.
The only time I ever saw my dad cry was when his brother died. And I remember seeing him walking down the corridor in the hospital and tears were streaming down his face. And I'd never seen that before. And it was amazing. It was like he was revealed in a way that he'd never been to me before. This is our family eating dinner. Dad sat at the same place at the table every single mealtime, and he always had a half glass of milk with his dinner. He wore a tie most days. He was evangelical in his belief that a good education was the road to a decent life. And he said things like, Van Morrison, blah, blah, blah. I wouldn't go to the back door to see that fella. This was more his cup of tea. Count John McCormick, the famous Irish tenor, of whom Dad never tired of saying, he's a papal count, you know. Dad never once told me, I love you. He was a generation and a half distant from me, and he never had to say it. it probably never even occurred to him. I mean, it was evidenced by the roof over our heads and the groceries that were delivered in a cardboard box from McClister's every Friday night, and in the colour TV that arrived one Saturday afternoon, and in the money that was always somehow scraped together to pay for a school trip for one of my sisters, or my first guitar, a black Harmony Sovereign with no bridge, bought from Harry Mulholland for £50. So saying, I love you, it didn't matter to my dad. It wasn't important at all to him. What mattered was what he did. At some point, though, the idea took root in my head that it was important for me to say I love you to him. And there's a whole lot of different reasons why that generational change happened. I mean, I've half a notion that it had something to do with the fact that we, when we were growing up, were living in cold, dark Northern Ireland, watching a lot of American TV where the sun shone, and people said stuff like that. I mean, nobody where I came from said that. I mean, they say it now, like they say it all the time now, but somehow it became important to name the emotions that you're feeling in a way that was unthinkable a generation before, or unnecessary. So anyway, fast forward a few years, I'm 30 years old, I'm going back to Scotland after the Christmas holidays. I was living in Scotland at that time. And Dad's given me a lift back to the boat. It's 6:30 in the morning, it's cold and damp, and I'm hungover. And we get to the ferry terminal. I did this journey a lot, and that ferry terminal is engraved in my brain. I mean, I can summon up a picture of that place, and I feel almost like I'm back there. And we're having a cup of tea, we're sitting in these white plastic chairs, then the shop shutter behind us rattles open, and I go in and I buy the papers, a Guardian for me and the Irish News for Dad. And then it's time for me to get going. So I gather up my stuff and we make our way over to the line where I'll go through security. And as usual, I'm never quite sure whether me and Dad are going to hug or we're going to shake hands or what. So we do this odd little shimmy and then we do a wee bit of both. It's like a half hug, half shake hands. And he slips a £20 note into my hand, which is something he always did. "Buy yourself something on the boat," he says. "Thanks, Dad. Thanks for driving me." "Ah, sure. It gets me up for mass." And then, at the age of 30, I say it at last. "I love you, Dad." And he sort of makes this strange little sound, like a... And he sort of laughs and says, "Same to you." And away he goes, off through the sliding doors and back up the coast road to home and a cup of tea and 10 o'clock mass. And I go through security and up the escalator and onto the boat. My mum, by the way, when I eventually got up the courage to say to her, "I love you," just said, "Aye. Well, sure, why wouldn't you?"
That was sound effect contributor and Seattle writer Dominic Black. This brings us to the end of the show. Sound effect comes to you from producers Kevin Kniestad, Allie Ferguson, and Kyle Norris. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. Parker Miles Blom gets the word out on social media. Special thanks this week goes out to Gabriel Spitzer, Nancy Leeson, and Dominic Black. We'll be back next week when our theme is Too Much Information.
Nobody wants you to talk about your dead mom.
Do you want to talk about your dead mom?
Yeah.
I'm Jennifer Wing. And this is 88.5 KNKX.